Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like civics, the law, anthropology, and archaeology. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
On this program, we're joined by Michael Running Wolf, Northern Cheyenne, Lakota, and Blackfeet, who was raised in a rural prairie village in Montana with intermittent water and electricity. Naturally, he has a master's of science in computer science, is a former engineer for Amazon's Alexa, and is an instructor at Northeastern University. He was raised with a grandmother who only spoke his tribal language, Cheyenne, which, like many indigenous languages, is near extinction. By leveraging his advanced degree and professional engineering experience, Michael hopes to strengthen the ecology of thought represented by indigenous languages.
Thanks for joining us today, Michael. We've been talking a little bit about how context of language impacts your design and your architecture and how you approach building these applications. Can we talk a little bit about how ethical implications of digitizing and recording languages impacts your design process?
There is this movement within indigenous communities in response to historic traumas and exploitation of data sovereignty or indigenous data sovereignty. And this is a movement that spans the globe. You know, there's Maori, you know, people in Africa and Asia and in North America and South America. How do we preserve our intellectual property rights from what historically happened to our material wealth? You know, like we have tribal artifacts, physical objects that have been stolen and put into the museums and private collections and removed them from our community. And we're now, as a global movement, toward how do we protect our IP, intellectual property, our songs and our ideas and our stories from having the same thing happen where people can take in, record their audio, and then store it away without giving anything back to the community. So that informs the ethics. As part of the ethical design of our project, it's more policy than technical. We don't want any ownership of the audio. A worst case scenario for us would be that we would be forced to relinquish the audio to a third party who is not under the authority of the community. It's very critical that the data that we have is only for the community use and our use. If the community wants to retract our use of their audio, then we would completely respect that. It's also part of the trust building as we're building this technology. We're taking a multilingual approach, and so we need to build relationships with many different communities to build our data set, to build our AI. And it's very important that we demonstrate to our communities who are sensitive to exploitation. And we also consider them partners. They're not research subjects, which is the typical term. They are our partners in building this technology. Quite frankly, they believe in the mission too. Like Sarah, one of our partners in for Kwakwala, was almost brought to tears and said, our language could contribute to your language's success. My language, Cheyenne, and she was like, that's amazing. How do we help? Let's do this.
What about privacy and security in terms of application building? I mean, maybe you have organizational or legal structures in place to keep this from being hijacked by a third party, but do you have privacy and security structures to protect the access or use?
Absolutely. I guess from my perspective as an engineer, it's not a technical problem. It's been solved. From a technical perspective, there are strategies and methodologies to secure your data, basically, and practices. Take, for instance, two-factor authentication, making sure that the data can't be accessed without a password plus another authentication system. There's different strategies. One of them is, like, there's a commercial project called YubiKey, and you never enter only your password, you also enter a random number. And I actually encourage you all and listeners to look into two-factor authentication. It's very critical. It stops a lot of privacy breaches. I would suggest you ensure that your email, your personal email, has two-factor authentication set up. And it's pretty simple. And so there's all these different practices and processes that exist. And I also have experience in this area. At my former employer, I used to work for the privacy and compliance team. My code helped make it easier to ensure that we were compliant with GDPR and CCPA and all this. And I can't talk too much about that necessarily, the NDAs and whatnot. I would love to apply that knowledge towards indigenous communities. To me, what is unfathomable is the policy framework, like what kind of contracts. I really want to create bulletproof contracts where we have no recourse as an entity, as the engineer using the data over the data. Like, I want to make sure that we have no permission to do anything. Like, even though we have agreements in place, but I really want to make sure it's completely legally tied up, because these communities, it's their data. And I want to make sure that they're not at risk by anything that we do.
You were talking about building trust with the communities. And this isn't a technical issue, but how do you identify who to make the agreements with? I mean, do you end up working with the tribal council, or do you try to get buy-in from every single member of the community if it's a smaller community?
You've identified exactly my worry. Most federally recognized communities have either a tribal historic preservation officer or equivalent. And their duty is to make sure that any research being conducted with outsiders, especially cultural specifically, are being conducted correctly. And that too actually would be typically the entity in which you would write the contract. And so, yeah, with the Navajo Nation, which I'm not, but if I was, I would need to get permission from their historic preservation office, and then it's likely they would need to have a resolution passed. But that's not always the case. It's imperfect. That makes it technical. It makes it difficult from a policy perspective.
That could be a tricky terrain to navigate in some cases. But it also speaks to your goal of just putting the tools back in the hands of whoever wants to use them. And then it seems like it would be a dead issue because they're taking care of it themselves.
Absolutely. That's the technical solution, is why be the middleman? Let them own the tool and let them own the infrastructure.
Whoever wants to use them within that community, right? It's sort of a balancing act, right? Making something that's extensible and easy to use, but also that can be protected by the community from unauthorized use by outsiders.
Oh, absolutely. For instance, Huaki'i does not have a cloud dependence. All the recognition happens on the phone. So if you go to the website for Huaki'i, the AI application, it's completely offline. There's no privacy issues. I don't see anything that they upload, because there is nothing to upload. It's all happening on device, offline.
Staying within this sort of framework, you know, you were talking earlier a little bit about going to the pipeline protests. You said you did some virtual reality recording.
Yeah, it's a story in itself, but we got funding, me and my wife and a couple of filmmakers, and we got a big experimental camera lended to us from Google, and we were funded by Facebook. And we went out there to build a virtual reality documentary of the pipeline protests. And we were out there from November until December.
This is why I wanted to bring up that particular project. Did you get permission from everybody to record them?
Yes. Actually, what we did is we were technically journalists of Yes Magazine. I authored a story as part of that project. We had boilerplate standard reporting releases that people would sign. And so we made sure to not record in public areas. People were very sensitive about having their face, because to this day, there's concern. Even back then, there was concern of facial recognition software. And now we didn't want our product to be used against people. So we made sure to be very careful. And yes, we filmed VR, but we were very careful to make sure that we weren't filming a bunch of people's faces at the same time. And we were being very obvious of what we were doing. So if we were filming in that area, we would tell people, oh, by the way, there's this camera here. You know, step back for a bit while that's going on. Interviews we conducted, we made sure we had permissions and forms being signed.
I'm a little curious, going back to some of the work that you did with the Indigenous Protocol and Artificial Intelligence Working Group. That was an international group. Are there materials that you all develop that sort of lays out some of the concerns that can be wrapped into the design process for immersive and machine learning environments?
Yeah, so it's a large document in which I contributed a very small portion of which, and I encourage people to look through it and read it, because it approaches this perspective of an issue of big data and AI and ethics of building artificial intelligence from a multinational perspective, and there's different essays in there. And this whole effort was led by Jason Lewis, who's a professor at Concordia, and it was funded by CIFAR, which is an organization based in Canada. There is a lot of stuff in there to unpack, quite frankly, but there's no answer to every possible question, but it does sort of bring forward the different perspectives that different Indigenous peoples across the world had toward this issue.
When you say this issue, what is that?
It's just like a multicultural perspective on AI. You know, like there's issues of ethics of potentially creating a sentient entity composed of electricity versus, you know, the privacy and data sovereignty. I was definitely on more of the data sovereignty topic and how it can contribute to a community. But there's different, more philosophical and esoteric topics also covered in that. It's a big paper. There's a lot of content to unpack.
You think we'll see a sentient AI in our lifetimes?
Probably. But I think it's going to be like fusion power. It's going to be 10 years from now. Like when you think of what is a human, it's an entity that walks, talks, and can play chess, right? And at one point, that was the test, you know. That was literally the test. Can this thing talk and walk and play chess? You know, but we can create robots that walk, and we can create robots that talk, and we have exceptional computers that can play chess. And I suspect, this is me theorizing, that the field of computer science and AI culturally is unable to do it. I think that we're just fundamentally unable to do it because of the culture of our field.
I know this is a bit of a philosophical digression, but I think it's fascinating. So what do you mean that the culture wouldn't allow us to do it?
I think the people who are into technology, we're all reductionalists, quite frankly. We tend to approach problems in a way that assumes that there is a pure reality. Like there's a fundamental truth out there, which I don't believe there is. I don't believe there's a one true philosophy or one true language, for example. And that there's a lot of that mentality within the field. Like this is the way, this is the perfect AI can only be constructed this strategy. And I don't think that that kind of mindset is not going to build general artificial intelligence. And so I think it's going to be an interdisciplinary effort, quite frankly, probably by a collective of women engineers, quite frankly. Because you need like this broad perspective and diverse perspective. And I don't think the field is capable of doing it from a cultural perspective.
Do you think that if we get to that level, is it possible that we might not even know, though?
I would say that I think we may have accidentally, or even just through emergence theory, where if you create the emergence theory, that complexity and then more complexity arises, which is how one way to see evolution. And so I bet we have created the equivalent of early bacteria on the internet. They're not sentient. They're life forms, digital life forms. I wouldn't be surprised if they exist. And maybe every once in a while, they just arise and then maybe they die out because someone turns off a server. I wouldn't be surprised of that. And one day, maybe if we have enough ambient compute power, it just might wake up one day and suddenly Siri starts to have a real personality.
Right.
Yeah.
By bacteria, you mean something that's self-replicating and lightly evolving. That's kind of what you mean by a little digital life form.
Your work is amazing, Michael. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And if you would like more information about Michael and his work, you can find him on LinkedIn. Just go search for Michael Running Wolf. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan Klum.